I began this discussion yesterday, but let me just sort of repeat myself just because, you know, why not? It's a new topic. So what I want to discuss in the next couple of lectures is aggregation kinetics. And so what is aggregation kinetics? Aggregation is the process where clusters irreversibly come together and make a bigger cluster. So if this is a cluster of mass I, a cluster of mass j, there is a rate at which these two clusters will actually join and make a cluster of some larger size, I plus j. So that is the basic process. And so first question is, like, why do we even care about aggregation? And the point is that aggregation is a universal phenomenon that appears in many different situations. We talked about making jello, which is kind of frivolous. There's gravitational aggregation. And another example that's really important, because we'd all be dead without it, which is that blood coagulation. When you cut yourself, you have a scab, blood coagulates. And that happens because of this aggregation process. So hemophiliacs are missing some protein that allows the blood to coagulate. And they're like, you know, any little minor cut means they could bleed to death. But because of good old aggregation kinetics, we all can survive. So thank God for that. So anyways, this is the process. So first of all, why study? Why care? So there's the applications. So I'll just put many applications. Applications. And another one is from the fundamental perspective, because as we're going to see, understanding aggregation kinetics uses a lot of tools, theoretical tools that are like important in non-equilibrium stat mech. So if you can understand aggregation kinetics, you'll actually understand a lot about how you go about solving complicated, nonlinear, interacting particle systems. So why care? One is many applications, and also develops many tools. Okay, so that's basically the motivation. The next thing is, and so how do we study this? And the simplest way of trying to study this kinetics is by making a couple of simplifying assumptions that allow us to write down some set of equations that describes the evolution of the cluster mass distribution. So the assumptions, and so these I mentioned last time, so I won't belabor it, I'll just be quick about it. There's four basic assumptions that go into to developing a theory for aggregation kinetics. There is perfect mixing. So I'm assuming that everything, you know, like I have something stirred up in a mix master, everything is perfectly homogeneous, so there's no spatial degrees of freedom. Clearly, that's not true in, say, gravitational aggregation, but at least it's a reasonable starting point for a lot of situations. So perfect mixing. Second one is that there's no shape degrees of freedom. No shape variables. So the only variable is the mass of the cluster. So mass is the only variable. So we don't care whether a cluster is a sphere or a string or something complicated fractal looking. All we care about is the total mass, and that's what's going to feed into like the rate at which two clusters meet, this Kij. The other thing is that there's we're assuming low density, so binary collisions only. And we're also assuming no discreteness. So we're assuming like a system that's so large that we never run out of clusters of any given size. So we can think about a continuous cluster concentration. This is the kind of thing you do in like electrodynamics or electrostatics, where one thinks about a charge density. One doesn't think about individual charges, but just a charge density that's like a mesoscopic, you average over some mesoscopic region. Yes?
So if we only consider like low density aggregation, mm-hmm. isn't there some point at which that assumption stops working because you get a cluster that's big enough?
Well, so no, but yeah, so one has to be a little bit careful about like, what do you mean by low density and no discreteness? Because as you point out, like if I had a finite number of atoms and I say make them all aggregate, eventually everything will be just one aggregate of all the atoms and nothing, there's nothing else left. So this these assumptions work in some kind of intermediate time zone, time range, where the number of clusters is large, but the number of such that we can think about an average cluster density. So it's the same thing as like in electrostatics, you know, like in sort of the very first lecture of electrostatics, you learn that how we deal with electrostatics, we don't think about individual atoms, but we say we average over a mesoscopic region that's large compared to the size of an atom, but small compared to the size of the entire sample so that we can have a continuous charge distribution. So similarly here, we can talk about a continuous cluster mass distribution in this situation.
So how do people go on to study like planet formation?
Well, that's a very interesting and a much more difficult topic. Most of that is done by like huge megascale simulations.
Okay.
Yeah, there's really not like very much in the way of fundamental theory on that. Okay, so those are the assumptions. And so now let me write down, based on these assumptions, let me write down the rate equations or the master equations for the evolution of the cluster size distribution. And the basic variable is going to be Ck of t, the concentration of clusters of mass k at time t. Or if you want to be in the continuous limit, we could think of similarly C of x and t, which would be if I treat now instead of having discrete masses k, I have a continuous mass x. So this would be the concentration of clusters of mass x at time t. So anyways, so Ck dot. So did I write this down last time or did I not get to this point?
You did not.
Okay, good. Okay, so Ck dot. So there are two terms. There's a gain term because I can create a cluster of mass k. How can that happen? I can take two clusters of mass I and j such that I and j adds up to k, and that's going to correspond to a gain term. So it'll be a summation over I and j with the constraint that I, well, let me write it both two things here. So it's a summation over I and j with the constraint that I plus j is equal to k. And then there's going to be kij, the rate at which I and j actually come together and convert, times ci cj. And then I have to put a factor 1/2 here. Because if I'm looking at, say, C67 dot, I could have a C40 and a C27. I could be 40, J could be 27, but J could be 40, I could be 27. And so to avoid that overcounting, I have to put a half. And then there's another term here, minus summation over all I from 1 to infinity. And here I'd have KIK CI CK. So this is the loss term because a k could bump into anybody else and then be converted to something even bigger. So this is the gain term, and this is the loss term. So those are the equations that we're going to be dealing with for this lecture.
But if you have a mass of 37 and a mass of 40 and a mass of 40 and a mass of 37.
Right. The thing is that in the summation, you know, there'll be a term here. There'll be like, you know, there'll be 30 and 47. That's ij. And then there's another term, 47 and 30, where they're mixed up.
But they're different.
But they're not different. How do you?
Is it because we assume the masses to be like indistinguishable?
Oh, so the clumps are indistinguishable?
All the clump is just distinguished by its mass. That's the only variable. But the thing is that your question is a good one because, like, when you first look at this, it's like, well, what about the 1/2? And you think about it more, oh, I see the 1/2. Oh, wait a second. You know, it's like you can drive yourself crazy about this. So I'm going to tell you a way to ensure that you know what the right answer is, because this 1/2 is actually a bit of a problem. And so it's an actually interesting point. But you had a question.
Should it be KIK in the last term?
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. KIK. Okay. So that's in the discrete case. Just for the point of view of completeness, let me write the same thing in the case of continuum. So CKXT, now this I guess I should write as a partial derivative. And so the analog of this would be 1/2 the integral from 0 to x dy C of yt C of x, thing is jiggling, x minus yt. And then there's a gain term minus the integral from 0 to infinity of, whoops, I forgot the reaction kernel, times K of y x minus y. And then there's minus the integral from 0 to infinity of cx t cy t k x y. And this is integrated over all y. And this thing, yeah, okay. So this is the discrete case. And this is continuous. So already these look pretty hard. And in fact, in general, this equation is not soluble. People have worked very hard at trying to solve these equations. And it turns out that they can be solved for very specific types of reaction kernels. So this thing here, Jij, this is called the reaction kernel. And it turns out that aside from things that are truly idiosyncratic and not physically interesting, the soluble cases are the following. Kij equals constant. Kij is equal to I plus j. And Kij is equal to ij. Constant kernel, sum kernel, product kernel, those are the cases that have been solved. And what I'm going to do in this lecture is I'm going to go through the solution for the constant kernel case because it's the simplest of this family of soluble models. And it kind of illustrates the basic phenomenology that's involved in aggregation. But before I do that, let me at least motivate how you could get constant kernel. And so the thing is that in the case of Brownian particles in solution, Kij physically is equal to two things. It's equal to a product of the radii of the particle. So clearly, if I have larger particles, they're more likely to actually collide with each other. So it turns out that for particles in three dimensions, Kij is equal to the radius of particle I plus the radius of particle j. And then it's also proportional to the diffusion coefficient of the particles. And in the case where I have two particles, each diffusing with its own diffusion coefficient, d sub I, it's proportional to the sum of their diffusion coefficient. So this is di plus dj. So this is the radius. This is the diffusion coefficient. And this is true for three-dimensional space. And so now, and again, if I was giving like a whole one-semester course in statistical physics, at some point I would actually derive all of this. But let me just sort of wave my hands and just say that, roughly speaking, this is proportional to this term here. Well, the radius, if I have spherical particles, is proportional to the mass to the 1/3 power. So here I get I to the 1/3. Here I'll get j to the 1/3. You know, with factors of 4 pi and things like that that I don't care about. And for the diffusion coefficient of a particle, it's one of these things in liquid state theory, which is to understand how the diffusion of a particle that's moving around in a liquid, how it depends on its mass. And it turns out that this diffusion coefficient is proportional to the inverse radius. And, you know, it sort of makes sense that the bigger a particle is, the slower it's going to diffuse in solution. So it should have some inverse dependence on the size of the cluster. And it turns out to be exactly 1 over the radius. And this is called Stokes' law. If any of you have like studied fluid mechanics, you'll learn about something called Stokes' law. And so the point is that this is proportional to I to the minus 1/3 plus j to the minus 1/3. And so from this, you get, you know, when you multiply together the direct terms, you'll get 2. And I'll get plus I over j to the power 1/3 plus j over I to the power 1/3. And so now you say, well, you know, if I'm doing aggregation, I start with a monomer-only initial condition, which is the natural initial condition to deal with. And so as a cluster as a system aggregates, there'll be some average cluster size. And so let me replace I and j by their average size. So this average will be 1. And so I'll just get something which is like constant. So actually, what I've just told you is actually bullshit, but nevertheless, it's not a bad starting point to motivate this particular case. And you'll see later on like why this replacing I over J by constant turns out to be actually wrong. But let's, for the sake of, you know, since we're all friends here, let's just assume that there's a typical cluster size, which there is. And so when I divide one cluster size by another, it involves the typical values, and I get something which is order one. So that's the starting point here. And now we come to some real work, which is...
What was the rate, the Kij was, is equal to the sum of the radius, KDI,
right,
times the sum of...
Diffusion coefficient, yes. So say that again, what was your question? Why? No, so again, thinking about diffusing particles in solution. First point is, if I have two clusters that are like of a given radius, the chance that we're going to bump into each other if we're randomly walking around, it's going to be some increasing function of the radius. Naively, you'd say, well, it should be proportional to the cross-sectional area. That makes sense, classically. But it turns out that when you're dealing with diffusing particles, the relevant measure of how big the particle is not its cross-sectional area, but its radius. So I'm just telling you that as a matter of fact. I can derive it if in a whole other class, but you know, just believe me that it's proportional to the radius.
So for what kind of particle is exactly?
Brownian particles in solution.
Brownian particles in solution is proportional to the radius.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. Is that sort of, it semi answers your question? Legally it answers your question.
Yeah, I can look it up later.
Okay, or I can derive it for you, but it's like, it's a whole lecture by itself. Okay, so anyways, so now we're going to deal with the constant kernel. The board is weird here. Constant kernel solution. So, you know, again, when you're dealing with some hard problem, like the best way to start is just to just write some stuff down and just try and get a feeling for it. So let's write down the first few equations and just see what we can learn from all of this. So also, for constant kernel, let me choose K, this is purely for convenience, Kij equals 2. You'll see why it's 2 rather than 1 in just in a while, but let's just take this case. So C1 dot, let's just write out the first few of the equations to get a feeling for it. So since our minimal size is 1, there's no way creating 1 MERS from nothing. So there's no gain term, there's only a loss term. And so there is a minus 2 C1 sum CK.
Sorry, why is Kij equal to 2? Shouldn't it be?
What?
Why is Kij equal to 2?
I just chose to be equal to 2.
I
could chose to be equal to 1. Is that what you'd like me to do?
Okay, it's fine.
What?
It's fine.
Yeah, no, that all that does is a change in overall time scale, but let me choose a 2 because my answers will look simpler with that case. And so this is this is summation k equals 1 to infinity. This quantity is basically the sum of all cluster sizes. So basically it's a total cluster density. It appears over and over again everywhere. So let me write this, let me define this thing to be capital N of t. And so I can write this as minus 2 C1n. It'll look a little simpler. C2 dot. Well, I just stare at my equations again. And so I'm going to have a 1 half, but k is 2. So it's going to be the C1 squared minus 2 C2n. C3 dot. Well, I'm going to have... I have C1, C2, and then C2, C1. And so I'm going to have 2 C1, C2 minus 2 C3, N. And C.
N's not infinite.
What do you mean N is not infinite?
If we're summing from 1 to infinity.
Mm-hmm. But it can be a convergent sum. It better be a convergent sum.
What are the C's?
The C's are the concentrations of clusters of any given mass.
Usually less than 1.
Well, I mean, again, we can choose our units to be anything we want.
Okay.
But it's just that when we do the infinite sum, it's going to end up being convergent sum.
Okay.
But not an unreasonable question, because sometimes there's weird singularities in these equations. Anyway, C4 dot, so here we're gonna have, so there'll be like a 2 C1 C3 plus C2 squared minus 2 C4n, and so on down the road. So first point, you see that n appears everywhere in the in the same way, everywhere n. And so this suggests the following thing, which is why not sum the left-hand side of the equations and try and write down an equation for n itself? So if we add these things up and see what happens. So let's look at n dot. So I take my equations. I'm going to now take the left-hand side of that equation and sum from 1, 2, 3, and add them all up. And so on the left-hand side, I'm going to get n dot. And on the right-hand side, what do I have? So I have, so the 1 half and the k, 1 half k is 1. So I'm going to have summation over all k, and then I have summation I plus j equals k, and then I have ci, cj, and then, And then I have minus summation over all k, summation over all I, 2, ci, ck. Let's see. I feel like I'm missing. Oh yeah, no. Okay. So, anyways, so when we do this sum, let's see what comes out. Well, the thing is that this was a constrained sum I and j such that I plus j equals k. But if we sum over all k, that's the same as just removing this constraint. And so now we have two unconstrained sums, and so we have sum over all I ci. Sum over all j, cj, which is nothing more than n squared. And here I have minus 2 n squared. So this is equal to minus n squared. So we have already a huge simplification, and we have our first result, which is that the total cluster density obeys this equation. So let's solve this equation. And so we're going to have dn over n squared is equal to minus dt. And I can write this as, so dn over n squared, this is d of 1 over n is equal to dt. And so I have 1 over n minus 1 over n at 0 is equal to time. And for the sake of simplicity, let me now assume throughout the entire discussion monomer-only initial condition. The IC, the initial condition, is going to be ck at t equals 0 is equal to delta k1. I start with only monomers. And so that means that n at t equals 0, which is a sum over all ck, is also equal to 1. So that means that n at t equals 0 also equal to 1. So now we can write the solution to this. So we have 1 over n is equal to 1 plus t. So n of t is equal to 1 over 1 plus t. So already one simple and nice result. The number of clusters is decaying with time as one over t. So now that we've found this, now you see that in principle we know how to solve this problem, because we have c1 dot is 2c1 times 1 over 1 plus t. So it's a simple differential equation for c1. We solve for c1. We have the result c1 is a function of t. Here we have, well, c1 we know now, and then we have c2 dot is a known function minus c2 times another known function. So in principle, we can solve this. And then we go to c3, and so we have c1 and c2, which are both known, and then we have a closed equation for c3. So we could go one by one and solve these equations one by one and get the answer.
Yes? The mass of the system is conserved?
Yes, absolutely. Okay, very good question, and it also pertains to Ali's question about the factor one half here. I'm gonna come to this in just a moment. So anyways, so that's a program that you might want to do if you're a masochist. And so the thing is that, but it's not bad, like as a beginning person, you know, I did this exercise for myself just to see like, yes, I can solve them one by one. But it turns out there's much better ways of solving this problem. But before doing that, let's come to this question about like mass conservation, because already two people have wondered, like, is mass conserved here? And the point is that by the construction of the process, clusters are coming together and just making bigger clusters. No mass is being created, no mass is being destroyed. So the total mass of the system better be conserved. And so one way we can check that is by looking at not the full distribution, but looking at moments of the distribution. So sometimes when you're trying to solve a complicated statistical mechanical problem and you're being asked to find the full distribution, well, you know, maybe that's too hard. And so a simpler thing that one might think about doing is looking at moments. And so what I mean by moments? So let me define the k, the nth moment, mn, is equal to summation over all k equals 1 to infinity, k to the power n, ck. So the zeroth moment was just the total cluster number. M0 was equal to n of t, which we already know. M1, by definition, is sum over all clusters, the mass of a cluster times the density of these clusters. This has to sum to a constant. So M1 better be a constant. And in fact, as we'll see, that this is oftentimes a good way to decide, did you actually write your equations down correctly? Like that factor 1/2 that was a little bit fuzzy, how to check that it's actually really correct. So let's look at equations for the moments, because we saw that the equation for the zeroth moment was simple. It was just n dot was minus n squared. Maybe other moments are going to have similar simplicities built into them. So let's look at m1 dot. This is nothing more than summation, kck dot. And so let's work this out. So what we have here, so we have, so 1/2 kij, so that's one. And so I'm going to have summation over all, so this is summation over all k equals 1 to infinity. So summation over all k, 1 to infinity. And then I have the summation over I and j, I plus, you know, I and j with I plus j equals k. But let me avoid having to write this over and again, the same thing over and over. It's a sum over I and j with I plus j equals k, but then summing over all k releases this constraint. So this is basically a summation over two independent indices, I and j. And then we have k, ci, cj, minus summation over all k. Then I have k, ci, ck, and then there's a 2 out in front here. So that's the equation for the first moment, dot. So what is this? So this guy, well, k, by construction, this is nothing more than I plus j, because I plus j added up to k. So k is I plus j. And because this is now an unconstrained sum, I have a sum, I have a sum I C I C j, j C I C j. But I C I is the first moment when I sum over all I, and C j is the zeroth moment when I sum over all j. And I've got two first moments. So the first term is 2 M1, and the second term is 2 first moment, 2 M1 M0 minus 2 M1 M0. That's bad. What happened here? I want to get 0 for M1 dot. So what did I do wrong? Did someone see a mistake? Oh, sorry. That's right. I did everything right except, so here, I, C, I, C, J. So I, C, I is the first moment. C, J is the zeroth moment. And then I have J, C, J, which is the first moment, times C, I. So this is 2 M0, M1. Sorry about that. And this is minus 2 M0, M1 equals 0. Yes?
Is there sum over I in the final sum?
Oh, yes, sorry. So this was, yes, sum over all I as well. Thank you. Kind of cool. So we found mass conservation. Indeed, the mass is conserved. The gain terms, the loss term exactly cancel. Let's look at M2. And so what is this? This is going to be summation k squared ck, sum over all k. And so this will be equal to, so for the first set of terms, I'll just write it as unconstrained sum over I and j, unconstrained. And then I'm going to have k squared ci cj minus double sum over I and k. And I'll have k squared ci dk. And so for this guy, I'll write this thing as I plus j squared. And so when I have I squared ci, that's the second moment, times cj is the zeroth moment. I'll have j squared cj, which is the second moment, times ci, which is the zeroth moment. So there's a term here twice, m0, m2. And then there's the cross term, 2ij. So that's twice ici, jcj, which is twice the first moment. So twice the first moment squared. So plus 2m1 squared. And then here I have k squared ck, so that's the second moment times the zeroth moment. So, oh, and I forgot the 2, sorry. And so this is minus 2m0, m2. But since the first moment is conserved, and if we choose our initial condition, that the monomer only initial condition, that says that at t equals 0, the total mass in the system is equal to 1. And so this guy, so this these guys cancel. And this just becomes equal to 2. And so I get m2 of t equal to 1 plus 2t when I integrate it. So when I integrate 2, I get 2t. And then
m1 equal to 1?
That's right. Okay. Right, because from the monomer only initial condition, when I sum k, ck, if ck is only 1 for k equals 1, then I just get 1 for the total mass.
And the summation was over I, j, and k for the first time, right?
Here? No. The thing was that it was a summation over ij that was constrained, but the k makes this unconstrained. So this is sum over just I and j unconstrained. So we see that now, in some sense, the typical cluster mass is defined by the second moment rather than the first moment. And that the reason for that is the fact that the first moment is exactly conserved. And so we can now do like equate the third moment. And so let's do it more quickly because you hopefully you see what's happening here. So for the third moment, you'll have something like that looks like case. Whoops. Raise this guy a little bit. So this is K3 CI CJ minus 2 summation K3 CI CK. And so this guy I'll write as, you know, I plus J quantity cubed. And there'll be two terms, I cubed plus J cubed. And so it'll be like twice M3, M0. And then there's a term 3I squared J plus 3IJ squared. So there's sort of two terms that are like very similar, which will be like I squared CI, which is M2 times M1. And then there's minus 2m3, m0. So again, these guys cancel. M2, we know it's proportional to t, and so we get from all of this that m3 is proportional to t squared. And you can find the exact coefficients. And in general, m sub n is proportional, I'm sorry, m sub n, the nth moment is proportional to t to the n minus 1. So that's the main conclusion that you get from this, that the moments of the cluster size distribution have simple time dependences that are just given by power laws in time. So that is kind of, and hopefully this answers your questions about the mass conservation story.
Shouldn't that be just 2t? Like m2 of t should be just 2t?
No, because at t equals 0, then you know we have to have it satisfy the initial condition. So when we integrate this, we have m2 dot equals 2. That means that m2 is equal to 2t plus a constant. and the constant we have to determine by the initial condition. So at t equals zero, if we have only monomers, that means that all moments are equal to one. Right? Some, you know, k squared ck, if the only term is non-zero, is k equals one, where ck of t equals zero is one, so we'll have one times one, so we'll get one. Yes?
I see the physical meaning of the zeroth and first moments, but what about the higher moments? What kind of like physical information?
Well, it's like the same thing, like think about the random walk. I mean, you know, the thing is that if we have a biased random walk, you know, the average displacement says how far you're going. The mean square displacement is telling you like how wide is the distribution. Higher moments are telling more detailed information about the shape of the distribution. So this is going to tell us things about shape of the distribution. But also from a statistical perspective, when you have some distribution, if you can't calculate the full distribution, moments are telling you, giving you more and more detailed information about the distribution itself.
So the higher the moment, are we gaining like more distilled information about it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, where did the one come from again?
Which one?
1 plus 2t, what the constant?
From the initial condition, because, you know, so the thing is that, again, the initial condition, where is it? I don't see it anymore.
Over there? Did you write it over there?
I don't know. It doesn't matter. The point is that, like, remember the initial condition, ck at t equals 0 is equal to delta k1. So I compute at t equals 0, k to the power n ck at t equals 0.
Oh, right.
So I just get 1 for every moment under the sun. Okay. So this is all well and good, but, you know, I'm beating around the bush because I'm saying, well, let's solve this problem. So why don't we just solve this problem? So that's what I want to do now, is let's really solve this thing to the very end. And as I said, you could be the masochist and go one by one through these equations, solve one by one. And, you know, I encourage you to do it. Like, I don't want to make fun of masochism necessarily. It's just every once in a while, it's useful to do these sorts of exercises so you feel like you know what you're doing. But now let me show you the elegant solution, which is the generating function, because you've seen now what's going on here with this thing. Mid front, I don't get this. Scroll. Manual. Oh, there we go. Okay. So let's actually let's do the generating function solution. So the idea here is that, and you know, in some sense, by the way, before I even do that, I mean, if we go back to let me just write down the equations one more time. So we have CK dot is equal to summation i plus j equals k. And then I have ci cj minus summation over all k twice ci ck. So that's the equations we want to solve. Another thing you should notice about them is that, what? No, I, yeah, okay. You know, the other thing to notice about this is that this, where I plus J equals K, this is what's called a convolution. You know, like if this was continuous variables, you know, when I wrote down the differential equation for continuous variables, inside the first integral, that's called a convolution, when the two arguments add up to like the left-hand side. And when you have convolution, maybe you've seen like in Fourier transforms or in Laplace transforms, when you have some structure which involves convolution, when you do the transform, you get product, which simplifies things. And so the same thing is going to happen here. This is a convolution, and so it cries out. It doesn't just suggest. It cries out, don't do it in real I and J, but do it in a transform variable. So in the case of continuous variables, we do a Laplace transform. But in the case of discrete variables, we'll do the generating function. So the generating function, let me define G. Let me use my, because I tended to use little g, I don't know why. Let me define little g zt to define a summation from k equals 1 to infinity of ck zk. And so let's let's do that. Let's take this generating function and let's turn this into a generating function type problem. So let's take this equation, multiply by z to the power k, and sum over all k from equals 1 to infinity. And let's see what comes out. And what we'll see by, you know, incredible magic is that instead of having an infinite set of equations that we have to solve one by one, we're going to get one single equation that's trivial to solve. And from that, we can then invert it and get the full distribution. So on the left-hand side of the equation, we just have the time derivative of the generating function. So on the left-hand side, we have dg of z and t with respect to t. For this term, let me just put a little worksheet over here. We have ci, cj, z to the power k. But by construction, k is the sum of I plus j. So I can write this as ci, cj, zi, zj. And then I have this k summation. And remember what that does. It makes this constrained sum an unconstrained independent sums over I and j separately. So we'll have ci, zi, cj, zj. Each one of these is a generating function by itself. So we're just going to get g of z and t squared. And then the last term, well, ck z to the k is just the generating function. So we have g of z and t. But then we're left with one more thing here. I forgot also there was a summation over I here. I forgot to write that down. But then I have some ci with no z. We're missing something. But the point is that some ci, that's nothing more than the generating function at z equals 1. So then we have here g of z equals 1 comma t. So it almost looks like a closed equation, except that g of z involves g at z equals 1. So how do we close this equation? Let's look at the equation for g at z equals 1. And so if I look at g at z equals 1, g dt, well, here, if I put z equals 1, I get g of 1 squared minus 2 g of 1 g of 1. So it's minus g of 1 squared. So in fact, everything is closed because, we know what g of 1 is. In fact, notice what g of 1 is. That's nothing more than some ck over all k, which was nothing more than the first moment of the distribution, which we already know. So we know how to proceed then. So to make life simple, it suggests, because you see this kind of looks like something quadratic, and here's something quadratic, let me define h of z and t. Let me define this to be g of z of t minus g of 1 and t. And let's look at the equation for h. And so dh by dt is equal to, so we'll have g squared minus 2g g of 1 minus minus, so plus g of 1 squared. So this is, you know, this is g squared minus 2g g of 1. I'm being more sloppy with my notation. I hope it doesn't cause any confusion. Minus g of 1 squared, which is nothing more than g minus g of 1 squared, which is the same as h squared. Pretty simple. So after all of this stuff, we get a really trivial equation. dh dt is h squared. And even I can solve that equation sometimes. All right, so let's solve it. So we have dh over h squared is equal to dt. And so that is d of 1 over h is equal to minus dt. So 1 over h minus 1 over h at t equals 0 is equal to minus time. So I have 1 over h. And not only put in the arguments to be really pedantic.
Sorry, Sid, how did you go from the h to the dh over dt?
Well, this is d of 1. This is
upstairs, up there.
Here.
The first to the second line.
This here.
That one?
So I just subtract this equation from that equation. Oh. That's all.
Oh.
Yeah, that's all. All right, so anyways, 1 over h is equal to 1 over h of z and t equals 0 minus t. And so now let's figure out what h at t equals 0 is. So h of z and t is equal to g of z and t minus g of 1 and t. And g of z at t equals 0, so we have summation k equals 1 to infinity ck zk. At t equals 0, only the one term is present. So g of z at t equals 0 is just z. And then g at 1 at t equals 0 is just 1. So this is equal to z minus 1. So this is equal to 1 over z minus 1 minus t. So finally, h of z and t, my generating function, is equal to, so let me write this this way, z minus 1, 1 minus t, z minus 1. So finally, we get this is equal to z minus 1, 1 minus t, z minus 1. So that's our solution. So you see that, you know, the equations themselves look pretty formidable. But when you do the generating function approach, you get a very simple looking equation for the generating function, which is readily soluble. And now all we have to do is invert this generating function to get the cluster size distribution and see and learn some physics. So I think this is a good place to stop. I will stop talking for 4 minutes. You can run out if you want or whatever, and you can ask questions. I won't go anywhere and take a break.
You said h of z and t, where I think probably t is equal to 0, right? Is that
where?
When you want to derive 1 over.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, so this is all at t equals 0. Sorry. So this is h of z at t equals 0. So this is t equals 0. Thank you for keeping me honest. G of z at t equals 0 minus g of z, g of 1. At t equals 0. And that's what that was. Thank you. Or merci. Yeah, no, I figured as much. Yeah, yes.
I was very confused about how we define c as the mass, and then we define.
So, say it again?
We define ck as the mass of cluster k.
That's the concentration of clusters of mass k.
So then we sum up all the CKs to get NK.
That's right, so that's a total number of, that's a total cluster concentration. So it's a total number of clusters divided by the volume of the system, for example.
So K is the mass.
K is the mass, yeah. And then I shouldn't say K after that. You know, like when you say, okay, K. So K is the mass, K? Oh, shoot. Okay, two more people here. I'll wait another minute. All right, let me continue along. So what I want to do now is I found the generating function. And as we see, by its very definition, the generating function encodes the entire cluster mass distribution. And one obtains the cluster mass, individual cluster masses, by making a Taylor series expansion of H as a function of Z. So we've got to do a Taylor series expansion. And in this particular case, because of the relatively simple form of the generating function, it's easy to do the power series expansion. So let me put this in a form suitable for doing the power series. So let me take the denominator and do a little bit of trickery with it. Let me write this as, this is not very tricky, but 1 plus t, the terms that don't involve z, and then there's minus dt. And this I can write as z minus 1. Now I can write this 1 plus t as a common factor outside, 1 minus z divided by t over 1 plus t. And hopefully, we all know how to do this series expansion. This is 1 over 1 plus t. Then I have z minus 1. And then here I have summation from n equals 0 to infinity of z to the power n t over 1 plus t to the power n. And so we now have to extract the, if I want to say ck, I want to extract the term of order z to the k from the series. And you see the series has got these terms, but because there's an extra z, there's sort of two parallel sets of terms. So if I want to find the coefficient of z to the power k, well, so there's two sets of terms. There's the k minus first term of this series will combine with the z to give me something of order z to the power k. So I have to take the k minus first term of this series, so it'll be like 1 over 1 plus t. And then I have t over 1 plus t to the power k minus 1. That's one term that'll be orders e to the power k. And then there's the kth term in this series without the z in front, but with a minus sign. So it'll be a 1 over 1 plus t, t over 1 plus t to the power k. And so this is equal to there's a 1 over 1 plus t common factor. There's a t over 1 plus t to the power k minus 1 common factor. And then I have 1 minus, and here I have 1 over t over 1 plus t. That's the only, because there's one extra power of t over 1 plus t to the power k. And this is just equal to, what is this? This is 1 over 1 plus t. So finally, we get a result that ck is equal to 1 over 1 plus t. Try and get this from bouncing. 1 over 1 plus t squared, which is this times that, times t over 1 plus t to the power k minus 1. So that is our final answer for the cluster mass distribution. So a couple of things to say about this. First of all, I hope you appreciate, you know, we've done a non-trivial problem, but with very little work by using the generating function approach. So that's one thing, just to marvel at like how much you get for how little you put in, if you have the right framework. Second point, which I find truly amazing, is that you remember maybe it was like 3 lectures ago, I solved the birth-death process, and I found the probability that there are n particles in the system. And that probability was exactly this. So second exclamation point, it was the same as the birth-death process. This is, to me, a complete mystery. Why? The equations are completely different in structure. One is a linear set of equations, one is a nonlinear set of equations. You get the same solution. So that's amazing, I think. And then to answer Ali's question, why did I choose kij equals 2? If I chose kij equals 1, then the answer here would have been t over 2 here, t over 2 here, t over 2 here. There'd be t over 2s everywhere. And by choosing kij equals 2, I got rid of this ugly t over 2 everywhere, and that was just more convenient. Yes?
I have a question about why we can, like, using how we can use this method, because I guess I don't know, like, because this is like, we're assuming that the solution has to be like analytically, you can do a Taylor expansion around.
Right.
I don't know how it works, but how can we know, how do we know like we can use this?
As opposed to?
Like solving the iterator.
Well, I mean, the only thing is that by its very construction, G was a Taylor series. As long as the radius of the convergence of the series is not 0, then it means that you have an analytic function, and then all of this is perfectly fine. So the only thing we have to worry about is it possible the radius of convergence is 0, which would mean that the ck would grow so rapidly with k that, you know, you have 0 radius of convergence. But in general, ck is decreasing as a function of k for large k, and so you never have this issue with convergence. So, I mean, yes, I mean, if we were mathematicians and said prove that the solution, a generating function solution exists, we'd have to work pretty hard. But, you know, I'm a physicist. I only am content to know the truth. You know, someone else can prove the truth for me, but I know the truth. And that's, you know, that's the fundamental difference between mathematicians and physicists. Yes?
We have calculated this using the expansion of x. But what we know is that x plus g at 1. Summation over all ck, which
z
is equal to 1 as well.
Right. What would I say to that? No, I mean, certainly what you said is correct. So so I should add to this. Yeah. Yeah, so the point is that g of z is g of zt is equal to h of zt plus g of 1t. So this is equal to like h, and then this we know is 1 over 1 plus t. Yeah, so okay, so I know what the problem is that all of this worked for the terms where k was 1 or larger. For the k term k equals 0, I missed something here, and that missing term is exactly this. So thank you for the question. Yes.
When t is non-zero.
When what is not?
T is non-zero.
Yes.
Ck is non-zero for any k.
Correct.
Which seems like physically nonsense because it means like there are some possibilities that
Have like a mass million like after infinitesimal time. Well, but I mean that's just the nature of the continuous equation. Like certainly in the discrete equations, the thing is that because it's continuous time evolution, that means that there is a very tiny probability that after time equals like 10 to the minus 9 seconds, I'll have something with a mass of billion. But I mean, it's the same as like say in the diffusion equation, you know, we know it's a Gaussian probability distribution. So that means that at t equals 0 plus, the probability of being like the light years away is still non-zero. It's like infinitesimally small, but it's non-zero. So that is a pathology of the continuous time evolution. And so that's just a fact of continuous time evolution.
I mean, it seems like it violates the mass conservation.
No. No, because the probability of having a really large cluster is so tiny that when I put it into the total mass of the system, some kck, you know, k might be a billion, but ck is e to the minus a billion. And so that's so much larger that that contribution will make no contribution. That contribution will have no effect. But yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, this does seem a little fishy that like at t equals 0 plus, I could have a really large cluster. But like lots of continuous partial differential equations in mathematical physics have the same feature. Okay. So I guess, yeah, so that is the behavior of the cluster mass distribution. But, you know, again, oftentimes when you have like the exact solution, in this particular case, the exact solution is sufficiently simple that, you know, you can look at it and stare at it and get some feeling for it. But in general, when you have an exact solution, you want to extract some physics out of it. So let's look at the long time behavior, because that's kind of the interesting regime that we care about. So let's look at long time behavior. So let's take our ck of t, which is equal to 1 over 1 plus t all squared, t over 1 plus t to the power k minus 1.
Sorry, didn't your gz, g of z and t start from, the summation started from k equal to 1?
Right.
But here your g and t has is equal to h plus 1 over 1 plus t, which is a power of z to the power of the second term is z to the power of 0.
Right.
Why does it even exist in that equation? So because you assumed your k runs from 1 to infinity.
Right. Right, but the thing is that if you stare at this thing, see this summation has a term n equals 0. So there is a term of order z to the power 0, which was that missing g of 1 that I sort of like fluffed over. Trust me, it's correct. I mean, you just have to like sit down and just write it out, you know, carefully, and you'll see that there's one additional term, which is the term that I forgot there that you so kindly pointed out to me.
So it cancels with that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, so let's look at the long time behavior. So again, you know, when I was a graduate student, when I was your age, you know, now I sound like a, you know, stupid parent. You know, when I was your age, you know, whatever, I mean, we didn't have computers. We had slide rules. But anyways, the point is that I was always like so focused on the exact result that I didn't appreciate that looking at the sort of asymptotic limit provides much more information. So let's look when t is really large. So what I argue is when t is large, we can forget about the 1 compared to the t. So we can write this 1 over t squared. Over here, when t is very large, this is, you know, now, I mean, there's like a small correction to, this is going to 1, but there's a small correction. And the small correction is what we want to focus on. So let me write this, let me divide both numerator and denominator by t. So I'll get 1 divided by 1 plus 1 over t. Power k minus 1. And then this I can write as 1 minus 1 over t in the numerator. And so this goes to 1 over t squared, 1 minus 1 over t in the numerator. And now, again, in the long time limit, like who cares if we're dealing with clusters of mass a million or a million and one or 999,999. So let's replace the k minus 1 by k. And then this is the same as e to the minus 1 over t in the limit of large time. And so what I get from all of this is finally 1 over t squared e to the minus k over t. So this is what's called the scaling form of the cluster mass distribution. And the reason why it's called a scaling form is that you see that the function is not a function of k and t separately in some arbitrary way. It's a function of a specific combination of k and t. So this thing, t, we can identify as sort of a characteristic cluster mass. And so I can write this as 1 over t squared e to the minus k over characteristic cluster mass. And so that's sort of the scaling way of writing this in the sense that there's a characteristic psi scale, which is growing like t, and that the distribution is sort of self-similar at different values of time. I'll get still exponential decay, but with just a different decay length. And so if you were to do a scaling plot, you know, we who work in statistical physics like to do scaling plots. It's don't plot the cluster size distribution as a function of k and t separately, but plot it as a function of scaled units, and then everything collapses onto a single curve. And when you see that, you feel like you understand something. So let's just do some plotting here. So first of all, let me plot as a function of time ck of t. So here is 1. So the monomers are decaying like 1 over 1 plus, so monomer c1. So this is 1 over 1 plus t squared. So that's easy. Dimers, so this is monomers, maybe. So dimers start off linearly because for when k is 1, dimers, 2, k is 1, k is 2, k minus 1 is 1, so this is linear in t, and then this goes to 1, and it falls off like 1 over 1 plus t squared. So dimers are growing linearly, and then they fall off in the same way. So this is dimers, another color, yes. Whereas trimers are starting off quadratically, and then doing the similar kind of thing. So this is 3s. So the cluster mass distribution is a function of time, you know, is doing this. Whereas if I look at the cluster mass distribution as a function of k, well, it's exponential decay. And so, and the point here is that it's exponential decay, but with an amplitude 1 over t squared. So, you know, here is it at, this is, sorry, let's make it early time. At early time, it's doing something like this. So this is early time, and let's try this chalk again. And then later time is doing something like this, and still later time is doing something like this. These are all exponential decay, but the width of the decay is getting longer. The amplitude of the decay is 1 over t squared. And so the right way to plot this is not in this way of just see it. The right way to plot this then is looking at not as a function of k, but as a function of k over k star, which is the same as k over t. And then the point here is that if I plot t squared ck, then I'll have some universal exponential function. And if I plot it versus k over k star, then I'll just get like e to the minus x. So my function looks like this for all different times, early time, middle time, late time. They all fall on top of each other. And this data collapse is like a very important feature that tells you that you're beginning to understand the problem because you found the right scaling variables and you've expressed everything in the right scaled units. So that is the cluster size distribution and its basic physical features. One second. One thing I just also want to mention here is that when I plot the cluster mass distribution as a function of mass, we see that the amplitude is decaying like 1 over t squared. The range is going like t. And so when I take the integral under this curve, which is a total number of clusters, the amplitude is going down like 1 over t squared. The range is t. which means that the integral under the curve is proportional to 1 over t, which corroborates what we already saw, that the total number of clusters decay like 1 over t. So you had a question.
Yeah, I have a question about, like, we did it a lot of times, like replacing the 1 minus 1 over t with e.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But
first term in the Taylor series.
Yeah, but by replacing with exponential, we're adding like further.
Absolutely. So exercise for you, which is to verify that if I keep the next term in the series, that it doesn't affect anything. I mean, yes, you are correct. If I want to keep the next term in the series, it doesn't look like it's the same. But in the scaling limit, this leading behavior is all that we care about. Mm.
So what do you mean it doesn't affect anything?
In the sense that there will be additional terms here that will vanish in the limit of t and k going to infinity. So that this is the leading behavior independent of anything else. So again, what I would argue what you should do is, like, you know, first of all, you know, e to the minus 1 over t has a Taylor series expansion, 1 minus 1 over t plus 1 over 2 t squared plus dot, dot, dot. This guy has in Taylor series expansion 1 plus, I went over here. This has a Taylor series expansion 1 minus t plus t squared minus t cubed. And so at least at the level of the next term in the Taylor series expansion, these don't seem quite very similar. So verify that difference doesn't make any difference. In the limit of k and t both large. Yes, I mean, they look different. I mean, the exact result is not the same, but the scaling result is the same. I know this is very hard to accept. I feel your pain and your confusion, because I did the same thing 45 years ago or 50 years ago. But, you know, at some point, like, you realize, like, what's important, what's not. So that's why I'm not actually sort of like showing you the answer. I want you to like see it for yourself. But I mean, it's very, you know, it's very natural to feel this sort of feeling like you're on quicksand. But you are not on quicksand, I assure you. Okay.
How did you draw the last diagram?
What do you mean, how did I draw?
I mean, what is the blue line? What is the white line?
So these are the different curves. But once I put them in scaled units, they all collapse into a single universal curve. Because I'm plotting not as a function of k, but as a function of k over k star. So all these different ranges, which are all different, are now the same range. And because I plotted this t squared ck, the different amplitudes are now all the same. And so that's why everything lies on a universal curve.
T squared times ck.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. Well, all right.
Is that the late times only? Or
yes. I mean, this is all for the long time behavior. I mean,
because the first diagram is for all times.
This one. Yes, that's right. Because this started t equals zero, but that's in some sense that's not the relevant thing for looking understanding the cluster mass distribution.
Also, I think for all times.
Yes, that is true. But the point is that by putting on a scaled curve, that means that in the long time limit, these curves will approach each other and will be exactly on top of each other in the limit of long time. Okay, so in the remaining time, what I want to do now is I want to introduce to you another way of solving this problem by scaling theory only. So the thing is that we saw that after doing a lot of work and, you know, just a lot of beautiful mathematics, I tried to argue that the right way of expressing the solution was in terms of scaled units. And so what I want to show you now is how we can attack the general problem with the continuous master equation over here by using scaling theory. And though we cannot solve the problem in general, we can get a lot of useful information without really solving anything explicitly. And this scaling approach is incredibly powerful and incredibly useful. And this is actually sort of the way that research physicists will attack complicated differential equation problems, by applying scaling theory. So what I want to do now in my remaining time is show you solution by scaling theory. So let's do the scaling solution.
Okay.
And so as a preliminary, let's solve something that we know what the answer is, just to show you like how the scaling theory works. So as a preliminary, let's solve the following differential equation. Solve dc dt is equal to d d second c by dx squared. So that's just the good old diffusion equation. And let's solve it with like the initial condition that I start with a particle at the origin, for example. So, you know, if I gave you this as an exercise, solve this equation with an initial condition, hopefully you then say, well, let me try and do Fourier transform, a Laplace transform, or generating function. I'd do something, I'd produce a lot of rigmarole, and maybe I'd even get the answer. But here what I want to do is I want to draw a scaling solution, which kind of uses some very basic facts and scaling, and from that you can infer everything with very little sort of real work at some level. So first point is that we have C of x and t. And I argue that the solution is not a function of x and t separately. We already know that from the Gaussian solution that x and t appear as a natural combination, x squared over t. So that's one fact we already know. Another fact is that if you look at this from the point of view of dimensional analysis, there's a c upstairs on both sides, and then there's an x squared downstairs, and there's, if I put the d down here, I have x squared dt. So already just by dimensional analysis alone, you should infer that x squared goes like the square root of dt. I'm sorry, x squared goes linear in dt. So that's already one thing very useful, is that you should always apply, you know, you probably learned in freshman physics to apply dimensional analysis to make sure that your problem made sense or your answer made sense. But dimensional analysis turns out to be an incredibly powerful tool in lots of contexts, and this is one of them. So that's the first point, is that average x goes like square root of dt. Second point is that, so let me now, let's try a scaling solution. So that is, let's try c of x and t as some function of x divided by s. So s here is meant to represent characteristic displacement of my random walk. And let's suppose I don't know it. I mean, I know it's square root of dt, but let's even suppose I don't know it at all. And now the other thing about this is that in order for this scaling solution to make sense, we need to have here a 1 over s. And why 1 over s? Because this distribution is normalized. I must have that the integral over all space dx cxt, well, that's equal to 1. But if I do the same thing here, so I take this and integrate over all space, so on the left-hand side I got 1, but on the right-hand side I have the integral dx over s f of x over s. But this is, I can now define a new variable z, which is x over s, and so this becomes like the integral dz f of z, which manifestly is something of order 1. It doesn't have any units in it. So we have, you know, we might be off by a factor of 2 or square root of pi or something like that, but the point is that the 1 over s is needed here to have the correct normalization of the function. And as we go back to our cluster mass distribution, where I said that the cluster mass distribution had a scaling form 1 over s squared, or 1 over t squared, e to the k over t, notice here that this I can write as e to the minus k over k star divided by 1 over k star squared. And this is the right form that has proper normalization, because if I integrate not c of x, c of k over all k, because that's not conserved, but I have a look at the total mass, which is conserved, that's going to be k ck integrated dk. And if I have k dk, that combines with each of the 1 powers of k star here to give me something which is manifestly dimensionless. So that's in some sense why there's a k star squared appearing here, or psi squared, and over here we have psi to the power 1. So what I want to do now is let's take this, this is what's called the scaling ansatz. Let's spell it right. So ansatz is a fancy German word for saying guess. So it's a scaling guess. But it turns out that if we make the scaling ansatz, so the program is the following. We like look at our equation, we try to infer some scaling form for the nature of the solution. We shove the scaling form into the differential equation and see what we get. And so let's do that.
It's called scaling. Like which part of it's scaling?
Because it's a function not of x and t separately, but it's a function of x divided by a specific thing here. So this, you know, as we're going to see, this s is root dt. So x is growing like root dt. So if the thing is that if you have a random walk, here it's spread out this far at early time, it's spread out by this far at later time, and this far at later time. But if I scale the deviation by the square root of time, then I'll have that the deviations are all exactly the same. So it looks similar. It looks the same at all scales. Okay, so we're going to take, so the idea here, a program. So one is make the scaling ansatz. Two is to insert in the differential equation. So ct is equal to dcxx. So here subscript means partial differentiation. And then three is look for consistency. And so we're going to do this for the simple case of the diffusion equation as a warm-up for solving the real problem, which is aggregation kinetics using scaling theory. So let's do that. So we have to look at what is ct, dc by dt. So here is our scaling ansatz. And one other thing I should have mentioned here is that this s is the characteristic size, which is clearly a function, or characteristic displacement, which is a function of time. So this depends on time. X is just the spatial variable. So when I differentiate with respect to time, there will be two terms, one where I differentiate here and one where I differentiate here. So for the very first term, I'm going to get minus 1 over s squared s dot times f of x over s. And then the second term comes because I'll have plus 1 over s. And then I have to differentiate this guy. When I differentiate with respect to time, I have to differentiate with respect to the argument. So this is f prime of its argument. So let's call this function here z. So I'll define here z is equal to x over s. So we differentiate with respect to the argument, and then we have to differentiate the argument with respect to time again. And so we're going to get minus x over s squared s dot. And so this, what do we have here? So we're going to have minus s dot over s squared. And then there's f of z. And from the second term, well, I have what x over s is a z, and then one over the s's came with this guy that came outside over here. And so I'm going to have plus z f prime. So that's the left-hand side of the diffusion equation. On the right-hand side, so this is LHS. On the right-hand side, so I have to differentiate twice with respect to x. Every time I differentiate with respect to x, I'll differentiate with respect to the argument of f and bring in an extra factor of s. And so when I do that, I'm going to have d over s cubed f double prime of z. So if we put this together, what we have here is then minus s dot over s squared f of z plus z f prime of z. So that's the left-hand side is equal to d over s cubed f prime of z, f double prime of z, double prime of z. So let's do some playing around here. So we'll get s dot over s squared is equal to d, sorry. Let's multiply through by s cubed. So we'll get s dot is equal to f double prime of z divided by f of z plus z f prime of z. Where do I want to put the d? Leave it here. It looks like I'm just going around in a circle, but at this point, I've done something really important. On this side, s dot. On this side of the equation, this is a function of time only. because S depends only on time. On the right-hand side of the equation, this, you have a minus sign somewhere. Yes, I do have a minus sign right over here. This is a function of z only. But z and s are, I'm sorry, z and t are kind of my two independent variables here. And remember, like when you first were solving like Schrodinger's equation or like the diffusion equation or electrostatics, you know, when you were doing separation of variables, you'd have a partial differential equation. You'd put all the x's on one side, all the t's on the other side, say, this is a function of x only, this is a function of t only. Two independent functions of different variables. The only way that that can work for all values of x and t is that both sides are independently equal to a constant. And that's what's, so we're basically separating the variables and solving separately for the time variable and the scaled space variable. And so let's call this constant just for the sake of fun. Let's call that little lambda. So let's solve these two equations, these two separate equations. Oops. Oh, this, wait a second. Yeah. I'm sort of running out of time here, so I'm going to get almost, I just want to sort of get to the point here, which is, so we have two separated equations. We have S, S dot is equal to lambda. And from this, we get that S of t, is equal to 2 lambda t square root. So we've now found something non-trivial, which is that the characteristic displacement is growing like the square root of time. And then the other equation is f double prime is equal to lambda over d f plus z f prime.
What is s of t at t equal to 0?
Well, this is only the scaling limit, the long time limit. So yes, at t equals 0, s of t is equal to 0. But you know, this is meant to be the long time behavior. Anyway, so and there's a minus sign. I keep forgetting it. Anyway, but let's do a little bit with this. So this is f double prime. This is equal to minus lambda over d. This thing is nothing more than zf, the quantity prime. So I can get f prime is equal to minus lambda over d zf plus constant. Let's call it, okay, constant. But at z equals 0, this is 0. At z equals 0, if I start with a particle at the origin, then by definition, the distribution is symmetrical, which means that the derivative has to be 0 at the origin. So this constant has to be equal to 0. So that we have then that f prime is equal to minus lambda over d zf. And so this is log of f prime is equal to minus lambda over d z. So that says that f is equal to some constant e to the minus lambda over d z squared. So we've in fact found not only the characteristic displacement, but the characteristic shape of the distribution, which is a Gaussian in these scaled units.
Lambda over 2D?
Lambda, yes, thank you. Thank you. Lambda over 2D, z squared. But now we know what z is x over s. And so this is equal to a, e to the minus x over s. But s is over 2 lambda t. This is going to be nothing more than x squared over 4 dt. Voila, the good old Gaussian distribution. And in fact, now the constant a we determined by normalization. And this we know is equal to 1 over the square root of 4 pi dt. So it turns out that in this particular instance, scaling actually provides you the exact solution. It's kind of a miracle that it actually happens. But the point here is that with very little assumption, just that the function, the original function itself, should be a scaling function of natural variables, we could then determine the nature of the solution. So what I'm going to do next time is I'm going to take that same program and apply it to my continuous distribution or my continuous master equation and try and get as much information as I can for the nature of the cluster mass distribution in aggregation kinetics. Okay. Which one? Why is this constant zero? So at z equals zero, this goes away. And at z equals zero, if my distribution is symmetrical about the origin, that means that f prime at zero is also equal to zero. So that's why the constant is zero. I'm done. Have I cooked you guys well?
Wait, how do we know? Is it just an assumption that the distribution is symmetric about the origin?
Well, if I start with a particle at the origin, and my equation has no left-right symmetry, then it better be symmetrical.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm usually pretty fair about these things. Yes?
Can you say again how you went from, how you took, threw away the lambda over the...
This? I didn't throw any.
Yeah, from the second to third.
From here to here?
Yeah.
Well, no, but... Yeah, it's just, yeah. So again, let me just be clear about this. Whenever I do a quick step that seems like I've done some black magic, these quick steps are always trivial. And so, you know, I will not try and pull the wool over your eyes. So, yeah. Okay, so I'm done. Any other questions?